Take a handful of people in a country of 1.3 billion, and what do you get? You get stories from the Street of Eternal Happiness. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you along, everybody. It's Monday, the 16th of May today, and have we got a deal for you. Thanks to the Securities and Exchange Commission, we can all now become fabulously wealthy venture capitalists. Or lose some money. Maybe a fair sum of money. Take your pick. The proximate cause is Title III of the Jobs Act, the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, signed into law 4 years ago. The relevant subheading is Regulation Crowdfunding. It lets, for the first time, regular people, that is, not registered investors, it lets them buy equity, ownership in a small business or a startup. And those startups are, as of today, right now, already advertising their cool new ideas on new crowdfunding platforms looking for small investors. Can you say small business startup ecosystem? Sure, I knew you could. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on it.
It wasn't hard to find small business advocates ready to declare this launch a kind of new day in America. Richard Swart is with NextGen Crowdfunding.
Small businesses can turn customers into investors or fans into owners.
And they sure could use the help, says Ted Zoller, an entrepreneurship fellow at the Kauffman Foundation.
3 in 5 fail in the first 5 years. And this is at a time when the cost of starting up is at an all-time low.
Zoller says equity crowdfunding could be key to help struggling startups get over the hump.
It's this early stage valley of death, the proof of concept period of a venture where the dollars just aren't very abundant. Unfortunately, they're the hardest dollars to get.
We're hearing a soundtrack for one product that launched its crowdfunding appeal today. It's the brainchild of three of the top electronic dance music DJs on the festival circuit. They're selling what they call Nice, frozen cocktails, mojito, margarita, in a paper cup. Spokesman Thomas Van Hare.
So every bit of capital we raise is going into the marketing. And this capital gives us the ability to grow faster.
Partly, he says, by turning every new investor into a brand ambassador, talking up the frozen cocktails to friends and fellow partiers. But Peter Cohen, a business lecturer at Babson College, says for any crowdfunding deal, buyer beware.
This is going to be great for the companies and bad for the investors. The odds of investors making any money on it are incredibly low. I mean, I think they should all expect to lose their money.
Because, like we said at the beginning, the odds of failure are so high. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, so here's the conversation we have in our morning meeting every time somebody brings up an oil price story. Somebody brings it up, and then somebody else says, seriously, we're going to do another oil price story? They go up and they go down. That's the oil price story. Well, yes, but crude is up today because Goldman Sachs got traders all excited over the weekend with a note that kind of flipped the script on the oil narrative of late. Rather than having too much supply and low prices, which is what Goldman said just a couple of 3 months ago, we are at a crude deficit, at least for now. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
The global market's been flooded with oil, but now that surplus is dwindling. Stephen Kopitz is president of Princeton Energy Advisors. He says the tightening market is welcome relief for struggling oil producers that have felt the pinch, even while consumers benefited from cheap gas.
But it's been all consumers now for almost 2 years, and we've had great pricing and low oil prices, and that's not going to stay forever.
Unless, of course, it is. Michael Weber is with the Energy Institute at the University of Texas, Austin.
Looking forward, I would guess that we've got a lot of stuff out there. Prices won't go too high.
By stuff, he means oil from producers that have turned their pumps off, but can get them up and running again quickly if the price is right. But he says, honestly, nobody really knows.
I think that predicting the future of these oil prices is a little bit like guessing the weather. We have radar and we have a lot of sensors about what should go on with the weather, yet we're so often wrong.
The models don't prepare us for Canadian wildfires halting production in the oil sands, or Nigerian militant group the Niger Delta Avengers blowing up pipelines. Oh, and add in how people, read markets, feel about the oil markets. Tom Wallen is with Energy Intelligence.
But it's pretty clear that when a trend starts to get going, that the financial investment activity in the market will add momentum to that.
And that, he says, is true whether prices are going up or are on their way down. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Warren Buffett buys a big slice of Apple and all of a sudden equities are all sunshine and light. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last year, more than 175,000 people came to this country on H-2 visas, the unskilled foreign worker program, mostly from Mexico and Central America. Employers of H-2 visa holders have to meet certain basic standards. They have to provide transportation to and from the border, housing, sometimes fair wages and decent working conditions. That doesn't always happen. Ken Bensinger wrote about H-2 abuses in his newest investigative piece for BuzzFeed. Jessica Garrison and Jeremy Singer Vine shared the byline with him. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
The upshot of the piece, the upshot of your investigation is this thing that seems ripe for abuse and mistreatment actually is.
Yeah, that's right. And unfortunately, this program doesn't have an ability, apparently, to prevent abuse and exploitation of these workers to happen. The Department of Labor, which is one of three government agencies that oversees it, told us that in 1 year they found violations of the law in terms of worker protections in 82% of the employers they looked at.
You start with an anecdote about a bus accident. Tell me that story.
It's a really harrowing story. There's a company based in Florida that brings in workers to do agricultural work all over the place. And a busload of these workers was done with the season in Michigan and was driving back to Laredo, Texas. And in North Little Rock, Arkansas, just outside of town on the I-40, in the middle of the night, the bus went off the road and hit an overpass, ripped off the back half of the bus, and killed six of the passengers instantly. I mean, just brutal. And as the mess was being cleaned up, it turned out that the driver of the bus, who happened to be the brother of the owner of the company, didn't have a commercial license, which is a serious problem. And on top of that, the insurance policy they carried was less than 20% of what it should be, which means that the grieving families are going to get very little money, very little compensation for their significant loss. Meanwhile, that horrible mess, which is being investigated as we speak by the National Transportation Safety Board, didn't stop the Department of Labor from issuing more visas to the same company.
That seems to me the big question, right? We have these bad actors in here, and you cite repeated instances of repeated abuse. What do you have to do as a company, as an employer? What kind of violations do you have to commit to get debarred from this process, from this program, I guess?
Sure. So, well, in theory, they should be able to debar, meaning get thrown out of the program and not be able to get more visas for a period of time. They should be debarred for the kind of violations we've been talking about, for exploitation and abuse. And, I mean, there's things like taking people's passports and not giving back to them and basically holding them virtually prisoner. But instead, what we find is they don't debar people typically for that. Typically, what they debar people for is bureaucratic snafus. And the most egregious thing you can do from the Department of Labor's perspective, apparently, is to not pay their $110 visa certification fee. Man. If you don't pay that fee, you're getting booted from the program real quick.
One of the subheadings, the sub-paragraph headings in this story is they weren't even allowed to Google them. You talk to people, I guess, at Department of Labor or who used to work there. They had to go only on what was on the actual form and application submitted by the company. They couldn't do independent research.
That's exactly right. So we spoke to a man who used to work in the processing center where they would look at all the applications for visas from employers. And he said that when he tried to do any independent research to find out anything about a company, even if there were red flags all over the place, he was roundly told not to do it, including not using Google. Literally, you have to believe what's on the piece of paper and nothing more. And so, no surprise, these things come through and people who are serial violators of people's rights continue to get visas year after year.
Outside the agricultural sphere, where might these workers wind up? What kinds of companies?
Several industries that we looked at are really dependent on it. Seafood processing industry. You see a lot in lawn care and garden care. Some of the biggest corporate-type gardening companies in the country. Golf course maintenance. The guys cutting the grass at the golf courses. There's a big industry that's called forestry or reforestry, which is not the companies that cut the trees to make paper or wood, but the companies that kind of clean up the mess afterwards.
Yeah.
Those ones are very frequently using foreign labor on these visas. That's an interesting case, too, because those are almost all done on federal land with federal contracts. So you have the U.S. Forestry Service paying companies to bring in foreign workers to do Forest Service work.
Do these companies need, I mean, they got to have these workers to get their business done?
They need workers. So the question is, do they need these workers? And if they need these workers, is that because they have really no alternative? And so that's one of the things we tried to explore is whether there truly are alternatives. We've all heard the old saw that no Americans want the job. And I think that in some cases that is the case. But there are economists and others who have studied that and have found that the rate of unemployment in these industries for U.S. citizens is fairly high and that there should be Americans interested in applying for the jobs. So people who look at this question think, well, maybe you need to make them pay a little bit more money, and then we can find out. That's sort of the acid test and see whether they really can't get any Americans to do jobs.
Ken Bensinger is a reporter at BuzzFeed News. Ken, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up,
you've got people who have made it, and you've got people who haven't made it.
Our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, and his stories from the Street of Eternal Happiness. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 175 points today, 1%, 17,710. The NASDAQ up 57 points, about 1.2%, 4775. The S&P 500, 20 points to the good, 0.9%, 2066. So Warren Buffett polishing the apple, as it were. News of Berkshire Hathaway's nearly $1 billion purchase of Apple shares in the first quarter. Apple dialed up 3.7% today. Microsoft delivered 1.4%. Unconfirmed reports that Buffett might help bankroll a bid for Yahoo, partnering with Dan Gilbert of Quicken Loans fame, sent Yahoo up 2.7% today. Google parent Alphabet gained 0.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We've come to that time in the television calendar when networks go all out to hawk their new seasons to potential advertisers. It's all very upbeat with various Kardashians on various red carpets and Jimmy Fallon cracking jokes. You know how it goes. Behind the scenes, though, there have been some tougher than usual negotiations over digital. Who gets to stream what and when? You, the viewer and consumer, figure prominently here because this is really all about what shows you can binge watch and when you can binge watch them. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour got that one.
To all of you out there who don't watch TV shows one episode at a time, but instead spend an entire Sunday glued to your screens, motionless, emotionally numb, bits of pretzels casually accumulating in your sheets, watching entire seasons at a time, well, you are causing a huge fight in TV world.
Definitely a lot of negotiation and conflict.
Ashwin Naveen is with Samba TV. They do TV analytics. So traditionally, when a network bought a show from a studio, it could broadcast the season's episodes, but it couldn't put them all up on their website for you to stream and binge watch. Why was it this way? Because your bloodshot, binging-addicted eyeballs are valuable.
What, you know, studios would like to do is preserve as much audience as possible to sell to other distributors downstream.
Studios want to sell shows to TV networks to broadcast, and then later they want to sell the same shows to streaming services like Netflix for bingers and latecomers. But these days, networks want it all. They want to broadcast a season and stream it, all of it, at the same time. Sue Akins directs UCLA Law's Ziffrin Center.
They don't want people waiting a year, cord-cutting, and saying, I'll just get a Netflix subscription, and then I'll wait and binge-watch it.
Networks are using all of their muscle in negotiations with studios to get the rights to let you binge watch current seasons now, with their ads, of course. And so far, the networks like ABC and NBC have been pretty successful. If that continues, says Eric Brannon with IHS Media,
it's very safe to say that the networks are going to win.
Despite everything you've heard about the decline of network TV, their checks are still fat enough that they can dictate some rules. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Consider for a moment the great conundrum of the millennials. Companies far and wide are trying to figure out what makes this generation tick so as to sell them more stuff. Companies, sometimes the same ones, sometimes not, are also trying to figure out how to get talented millennials to come work for them. And Wall Street is not immune. Not long ago, finance had its pick of the best and the brightest. But with their reputations still recovering from the financial crisis and tech careers all the rage now, banks are having to work a lot harder to scoop up top talent. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on one big bank that is trying something different.
Part of how Kevin Miranda decided on a banking career involves a very unexpected place, the school playground at a low-income community in Ecuador. Miranda and several of his Boston College classmates spent time there during a school break, connecting with young students and learning about community development. He also volunteered in Peru for a nonprofit, teaching English to students with limited resources. Service is big for him.
One of the issues that I find very important is education inequality. That's something I'm passionate about in terms of improving, especially in developing countries.
That may not sound to you like a student bound for banking, but the senior graduating with a degree in international studies is taking a job at Citigroup. But Miranda's not joining the waves of dark-suited young men and women directly from school.
Before I become an analyst, I accepted a spot in a fellowship in which I'll complete a year of service.
And this is not some gap year thing he cooked up himself. It is part of his job at Citi, in partnership with a nonprofit called Service Corps. Citi pays him 60% of base salary during the year, where he'll work to grow opportunities and partnerships for charitable organizations. Then he'll start work at the bank. The chance to be at a nonprofit before banking was key to Miranda's choice of employer.
I knew this essentially would give me the best of both worlds. I think having both those experiences could help me develop as a person and as a professional and help me get some really good perspective on what I think I should do to impact the world.
He's part of the first class of Citigroup hires in the bank's Year of Service program. It's a pilot for now, with just a handful of participants. There's a warm and fuzzy altruistic exterior to this, but beneath it are hard business realities. Banks need to draw the best students to win. Citi's betting that offering a year of service will make it more competitive in recruiting.
This is the future of the firm.
Raymond McGuire is Citi's global head of corporate and investment banking.
The generation wants to make a difference. They want to make certain that the talents they have, the skill sets that they've developed, can be deployed in the workplace, but importantly, outside of the workplace as well.
The year of service is part of a larger program aimed at keeping Citi's young bankers happy, including opportunities for current employees to do shorter service projects, emphasis on work-life balance, and faster paths to promotion and new challenges. Other banks are also making changes to appeal to younger workers.
I've been in this business for 30-some-odd years. I've seen different cycles of how we manage our talent. This is a different dynamic.
You can see this play out at Princeton, historically a fertile recruiting ground for Wall Street. Nearly half of 2006 Princeton grads with full-time jobs worked in finance and insurance. Last year, that number was down to 21%. Balin Sangvi runs Princeton's Career Services Office. He says more companies are making service opportunities part of their pitch because students demand them.
They look at the opportunity to do something radically different, something that might have a strong service streak, and they see it as a particularly low-risk period in their career where they can immerse themselves in it.
He says big consulting firms are also experimenting more with letting new hires do service before their start date, and companies of all kinds are offering employees time to use their skills for social good. Here's Kevin Miranda again.
It's essential that my generation is able to have that type of learning experience to personally grow and then ultimately professionally grow.
Wall Street is slowly realizing how the recruiting game is changing. What'll be interesting to watch is whether this new generation of bankers actually changes Wall Street itself. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz did a series about the people who live and work on a single street in Shanghai, the Street of Eternal Happiness, and how they get by in today's Chinese economy. That series, I'm happy to say, is now a book. It's called The Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. And we, as makes sense, get first crack at Rob as he starts his book tour. Rob, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Tell me where the idea, I will say the brilliant idea for this book came from.
This came from me, I think, being overwhelmed by the barrage of news and the news cycle from China. You know, China's kind of a big place.
Yeah,
it's kind of a big economy. And I wanted to take a step back and focus on real life, everyday Chinese people, because I think that in some ways is what's lost when we focus on the economic and the political news coming out of China, because the party controls a lot of that information.
Let me get you to the subhead
of this book, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. What is the Chinese dream today?
Well, the Chinese dream is an interesting concept. It's a political concept. It's a guiding principle for the current leader of China, Xi Jinping, and what Xi Jinping calls the renewal of the Chinese nation. And, you know, that may have been an attractive concept 20 or 30 years ago when most Chinese were poor and they all shared the same vision of economic prosperity for themselves and their country. But, you know, times have changed. You've now got hundreds of millions of Chinese who are in the consumer class, and their dreams go beyond money. So the characters that I profile in my book are searching for things like a deeper spiritual meaning amongst all this materialism. They're dreaming about justice and equality under Chinese law, and they're dreaming about improving themselves as individuals.
How old is your oldest son? He's like 7, 8 now, right?
He's 7 years old.
Okay. There's going to come a point where you guys are going to come back to the States and he's going to go to school and whatever. If he goes back to China in like 20 years, what's he going to find?
Wow. It's hard to even predict what China's going to be like in a year because things are happening so quickly. But in 20 years, I hope he'll find a country that has figured out how to make this economic transformation work for itself. Because I think it's in all of our best interests, and I'm speaking as an American here, that China succeeds. Because I think that China is a very important part of the world. It's a very important part of the global economy. So I think what I hope to see is that the new generation of leaders who are younger and did not grow up during tumultuous times under the Mao years have a new vision for China and are more progressive about that.
Since you mentioned the Mao years, this week is roughly dated 50 years since the start of the Cultural Revolution over there. Obviously a seismic event in that country. It is still, that event is still affects China today. It affects its economy and its political system and everything, right?
Absolutely. There's an entire generation, and this is, we should remember, Xi Jinping's generation.
Yeah.
They grew up having the state basically determine every single career shift in their life up until the age of around 40. So now in this new China, where capitalism reigns, they feel lost. And there are a few characters in my book, one of whom is named Auntie Fu, who gets involved in all of these awful pyramid schemes. She sees all this wealth around her, and she doesn't understand how people got it. And the reason she doesn't understand this is because she grew up in that very warped time. And the Cultural Revolution had a very, very profound impact on everyone who are in their 60s right now.
And they're trying to figure out their way in the modern economy, right?
They're trying to figure out their way in the modern economy. And I think that it's interesting, you know, when you look at the leadership of China, you know, obviously the leader right now, he came out of that generation. The difference between that generation and the next generation after them is enormous. And I think that it's going to be interesting after Xi Jinping gives up power, if that happens. What will happen to the leadership? Because I do think that we're going to see the beginning of some very interesting changes for China because the next generation in China is really so different from this current generation that's leading the country.
We got a little bit off topic with Rob Schmitz, but his book was the start of the conversation. It is called Street of Eternal Happiness, Big City Dreams Along a Shanghai Road. He is our man in Shanghai. Rob, thanks a lot. Great book.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Rob's going to have a couple more stories from the Street of Eternal Happiness for us in the next couple of weeks. Updates on the people who live and work there from when the original series aired 3 years ago, which, by the way, you can listen to marketplace.org. Check it out. This final note on the way out, another installment of our Every Now and Then segment, The Soundbite.
The art of the soundbite.
Works like this. We play a piece of tape, then tell you what's actually going on. Today, the all-but-certain Democratic nominee for President of the United States, Hillary Clinton, who in a speech this weekend said this.
My husband, who I'm going to put in charge of revitalizing the economy, because, you know, he knows how to do it, and
Setting aside the unfortunate, you get two for the price of one historical callback. What Secretary Clinton said is kind of true. Wages were up under President Clinton. Poverty and unemployment were down. But then again, Glass-Steagall was repealed. There was that stock market bubble thing. And let's not even start on NAFTA, all right, because reasonable people, as they say, disagree. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. Your gift in any amount will be automatically doubled this month thanks to the generosity of Newman's Own Foundation. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. Not a bad Monday, you know, for a Monday. The Dow up 175 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ up 57 points, 1.2%. The S&P 520 points higher, 0.9%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
This is APM.